entrepreneurship felt very expensive to me. It felt like that expensive store on Fifth Avenue that you walk by and you could see the shiny objects from the window, but it wasn't worth your time walking in because you knew you couldn't afford it. So it was always something that I had deep desires to do, like deep urgings to do, but didn't know exactly how to do it. Music in particular is something that we all have a soundtrack to our lives, right? We all participate in wedding showers or baby showers or graduations and birthday parties where we include music. We're actively participating, whether passively or subconsciously, in the music ecosystem almost every day, multiple times a day, whether we realize it or not. It's not as discretionary as you may think that it is. It is actually pretty much a durable. You've seen over these periods of times and cycles where, again, consumption continues to stay flat, if not even grow, as you face any of these periods of uncertainty.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Charisse Clark-Soares, who is the founder and CEO of Harborview Equity Partners, which is our second time founding a fund, having previously founded Tempo Music Investments. Charisse has had over 20 years' experience in leadership roles across corporate finance, with a particular focus on the communications, media, and entertainment sector. She has been recognized in the Billboard Top Women in Music 2020 and 2022, Change Agent List 2021, and Dealmaker List 2020, and was named one of Variety's Women of Impact 2022. She was also featured in Buyouts Magazine's Women in Private Equity Class of 22. She sits on the board of a public company, Evoqua Water Technologies, is a member of the Board of Trustees of Carnegie Hall, and the treasurer and national board member of Planned Parenthood of America. Welcome, Charisse. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, great. Well, let's start with where you grew up and what your early interests were and how ultimately you came to enter the world of investing and finance.
I am a native New Yorker. I grew up in Queens, New York, on the border of Queens and Long Island. My parents are immigrants to this country. I'm a first generation American. And I really grew up watching my dad, who was an entrepreneur and built his way in this world. First, candidly, as a taxi driver, but then ultimately as a person who did local real estate and really kind of learned a lot of my, I would call it, early transactional or love of a deal chops from him, in watching him look at real estate. Local real estate wasn't huge deals, but look at real estate opportunities, make bets, work with financing partners, and do that over the course of his career and his professional life. So that was a big part of just my raw investing chops. But both of my parents really encouraged my arts and arts education throughout my life. I played the piano for 15 years. My mom introduced me to making sure that I knew musical theory and musical works very, very early, to the point where I was classically trained and took exams with the Royal Board of Music for several years. And then in high school and college, had the opportunity to serve as leadership roles in all the creative arts organizations in school. And very much so, my parents kind of thought about the arts as a very big portion of our lives and livelihood growing up. So every year for Christmas or around Christmas at City Center for probably 20 plus years growing up, my father took me to see Alvin Ailey at City Center, and my whole entire family. And so that was a special moment for us and really kind of connecting with art and art institutions around the world. And so forever, my passion has been really driven by merging these two things, really having the ability to kind of think about creatively how to pursue different transaction opportunities and to be an investor and to be a principal and take a point of view on something, and intersecting that with the impact that arts and arts education have had on my life.
Well, we're certainly going to dig into the dynamics and the specifics of how you fuse those two passions of business and arts. But before that, just wanted to ask about what drove you to strike out on your own in business, because you've done it twice now.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Well, there's a couple things. First is, obviously, as I mentioned, my dad was an entrepreneur. So there's always been like this entrepreneurial spirit in me, always wanting to find a path to entrepreneurship, but not really having truly the risk tolerance to basically stand up on my own and go out and start something from scratch or be unemployed. Candidly, I have a lot of financial responsibility to my own personal family, but also to my extended family as well. So it was always, entrepreneurship felt very expensive to me. It felt like that expensive store on Fifth Avenue that you walk by and you could see the shiny objects from the window, but it wasn't worth your time walking in because you couldn't afford it. So it was always something that I had deep desires to do, like deep urgings to do, but didn't know exactly how to do it. I spent the vast majority of my career at Morgan Stanley, where I was kind of raised professionally. A lot of really amazing professionals, many of whom have been mentors to me and partners to me throughout the entirety of my career, but certainly are people who probably don't even realize how many of the nuggets I take with me every single day of things that they've said to me over the years. And while I was there, I had a lot of experience in the TMT sectors and had been looking to create opportunities internally around the space. And ultimately, as we were kind of putting it all together, it made more sense for it to live externally. But it was really that kind of entrepreneur and focus of mine of really looking to build and create new products that actually took me from point A to point B. So that's really sort of what kind of led me to strike out on my own. It's always been sort of on the vision board and on the dream board, not necessarily knowing how to get there, thinking that I would have to be an entrepreneur just given my risk tolerance, and then ultimately finding a path by just constantly looking at the landscape and taking advantage of opportunities that were presented to me that led me to sort of really being an entrepreneur.
It's interesting. You mentioned the intrapreneur route, and obviously a key difference there versus going out completely externally might be the capital. Can you describe your experience in, you know, raising capital, hiring for your new enterprise, building a brand, some of which maybe doesn't get as much emphasis in the intrapreneur kind of framework?
Yeah. So look, I think there's a lot of frameworks that exist for people starting new asset management firms that can sometimes be challenging for people who come from backgrounds like mine to sort of tick all those boxes. But hopefully I'm here to start with an example of there's a path and there's a way to think about doing it. I think some of the things that you really want to be thinking about is how you sort of come to market. You can come to market with partners or without partners, may take you a longer time, but give you more ownership and control over the long tenor. You can come to market with partners, in which case coming to market with a partner allows you to get accelerated as it relates to how you launch. And so for me, as I was thinking about starting Harborview after having started something previously before, I knew I wanted a partner and an institutional partner. And so I went out looking for an institutional partner that could really be thoughtful about being a partner, right? There's lots of people who want to be an owner of your ideas or of your opportunities, but there are institutions out there that are looking to partner with great platforms. And so I was out looking for a partner, and I did that deliberately to really accelerate the launch of the firm, which helped me with hiring and et cetera. And then as it relates to developing a brand, one of the benefits of living and working professionally at a great institution like Morgan Stanley for so long is you really do understand the art of how you tell your story to the market. And so developing and building a brand around authenticity, around who we want to be, is something we take very seriously. We, in fact, have a team that is focused on business development and focused on our outward facing engagement. And that we think is super important to making sure that people, we at least convey to the marketplace who we want to be. And it's never a perfect science, but it's really important to me. As it relates to hiring, one of my dear friends and longtime mentors and partners always used to tell me, her name is Melissa James. She's a vice chairman at Morgan Stanley, would always tell me, "Charisse, your job." And she told me this from when I was kind of a senior VP before I even made principal at Morgan Stanley, let alone partner, but your job, she would tell me, is to always keep your eye on talent. And so for me, as it relates to hiring, you'll see an amalgamation of really high quality people that we have at Harborview that really is an amalgamation of talent that I've come across over my decades of work, my work experience across the space. And even if I didn't know them directly, they came almost to a person through relationships that I had around talent. And that's really, really important to me, especially building something early, because you want to have a cohesive culture as well as people who you believe in and can trust with your vision on helping you to execute that. So that's been really important to me in terms of how we think about that and the complexion of what we want the organization to look like. It was really important to me and continues to be important to me, especially as we continue to scale, to really position ourselves as the next generation of asset managers. If you think about the legacy institutions like Apollo, even who's our partner, or Carlyle or KKR or TPG or any of these institutions who we have a lot of deep respect for and really respect what they've been able to build, we're excited. They're about 40 years old, I'd say, give or take. And so if they're the parents and we're the kids, we're excited to be sort of that next generation of what these organizations look like in terms of how we reflect humanity, how we think about investing in underserved and underinvested and underpenetrated markets, how we think about making sure that we're thinking about our impact to not only creating great returns for our stakeholders, but our impact in the world. These are the things that kind of really excite me as well as we think about hiring and building out the firm.
So interesting. I do think in today's market, we need to emphasize more than just the salary that someone's going to get. There has to be a purpose, a mission, some, as you said, impact behind that. Love to dig in now, because you mentioned being a second generation asset manager. And we've spoken before about how you differentiate your approach. Can you take us just back to basics in terms of what you were doing in the entertainment sector, how you're using data, how you're maybe differentiating yourself a little bit differently, and how your investment product is set up?
Absolutely. So Harborview is a sector-focused private equity and asset management firm focused on the entertainment and media sector specifically. Our first strategy is to acquire music royalties. And so we're very focused on acquiring cash flows that are generated from the monetization of musical works. And we do that by acquiring catalogs from either individual artists or songwriters, but also entities or platforms that may own or have aggregated these works. Our focus is on really thinking about the asset class at scale and really being a partner to the ecosystem overall. But we do that by really being thoughtful about what we think and how we see the cash flows performing both historically, but what we think they will do on a go-forward basis. So we have a very particular focus on seeing all those opportunities through a data lens, which allows us to, we think, create a diversified kind of fixed income replacement strategy, if you will, for the marketplace that creates non-correlated cash flow streams that also have very little variability in how they perform over time. And you wouldn't be able to be thoughtful about that if you didn't really take a point of view on how you've seen these cash flows perform historically and what you think they can do on a go-forward basis statistically. Prior to launching into investing in the music catalog space, I actually helped to manage a large credit portfolio at Morgan Stanley. And a big part of the way that we've designed how we think about managing this risk is very similar to that risk, in that when you're owning a book of corporate bonds or corporate loans, you're not always driving the ship on how each one of those things perform, but you are driving the ship on how you aggregate and assemble this portfolio. And in that context, we use a lot of quantitative risk metrics to do that and to manage that risk portfolio. And so for us, that's something that we see a very similar correlation to how we think about music and music catalogs. And we're very focused on making sure that we tie those things together.
And how do your investors tend to look at you in terms of fitting into a portfolio? You mentioned being a sector-focused private equity fund, but music royalties sometimes have a category all their own, given their sort of contractual nature. There's a constant income. That income probably comes in from the very beginning, as opposed to having to wait out the J curve. How does this fit?
Yeah, exactly. So one is investors who come into our portfolio have very little J-curve impact, or they don't have the same depth of a J-curve is probably the better way to say it, because we do invest in assets and then immediately get yield against those assets. And so that helps very effectively with that J-curve analysis. But typically, most people are looking at this from either an opportunistic credit bucket, a private credit bucket, in some instances, a real assets bucket, and in some instances, even a private equity bucket for our music royalty strategy in particular. And I'd say that is driven by how they define those different strategies. And so they may define private credit as only lending. We're obviously not lending in this instance. They may define private equity as only buyout, in which case we're not doing buyout in this instance. But some people define either of private credit or private equity as really just owning an asset and owning it outright, in which case we do in both of those instances, and it just depends on return profile. And so we've seen a diversity of outcomes as it relates to how people think about allocating to a strategy like ours. I'd say in this current environment, just given the level of uncertainty around a lot of things, are we in an inflationary period? Are we heading into a recessionary period? Are we going into stagflation? Our product, by and large, is not, at least from a top line perspective, as impacted relative to all of those various volatility moves, which is really nice to see because it is, again, kind of non-correlated. And so we've seen a decent amount of interest from investors around our product, given that we are very focused on using data to create what we believe is a long duration, stable cash flow stream that, again, doesn't have or a correlation to some of these broader supply chain / wage inflation or cost inflation issues in the same way. So investors, I think, have been excited about that and excited about that in various different buckets based on how they define those individual allocation buckets.
And just for those of us who aren't immersed in the music business, is it fairly resilient to economic cycles? Do the royalties tend to change around as perhaps, let's say, the economy is less buoyant? Or is it completely uncorrelated?
Yeah. So I'd say two things. One of the reasons why we're bullish on the entertainment and media sector as a firm is that if you look at history in terms of various cycles, whether it's the 08 recessionary period or you look at other recessionary periods that have occurred over time, you'll see that content and content consumption actually may experience some slight flattening, but it doesn't have the same trade-off and value that other segments of the industrial complex would have. And that's because the accessibility of content for most of us is pretty inexpensive on a relative basis to access. It's also a big part of the human condition, i.e. music in particular is something that we all have a soundtrack to our lives, right? We all participate in wedding showers or baby showers or graduations and birthday parties where we include music. We're actively participating, whether passively or subconsciously, in the music ecosystem almost every day, multiple times a day, whether we realize it or not. In the active side of the equation, we're going to Spotify and downloading our favorite playlists or playing our favorite songs or listening to today's New Music Friday, listening to new music that's come out today, or we've shown up to the gym or to a restaurant or to the supermarket and on the loudspeaker, you're hearing music engaging to play and create a certain environment in those establishments, or we've gone to a concert or a music festival. So we're always participating in music. We almost participate in music in a way that's not dissimilar from how we use our credit cards or otherwise. And so you combine that with how we think about music. It's not as discretionary as you may think that it is. It is actually pretty much a durable. You've seen over these periods of times and cycles where, again, consumption continues to stay flat, if not even grow, as you face any of these periods of uncertainty. So from a top line perspective, I could tell you that since January of this year, when the market's been going through and roiling through this conversation of, are we on the verge of a recession or not? Are we in an inflationary period or are we about to hit the brakes on growth pretty materially if the Fed continues to raise rates? You have not seen any material impact to our top line as it relates to consumption and or royalties. And so it's kind of, again, evidence of continuing to be really kind of non-correlated and not having the same volatility that you would see in other sectors that may be experiencing either spikes or declines from various other contagions in the market.
Well, let's move now to the question of diversity, because it really touches this topic in so many ways. A, because some of what you do is discover talent that is perhaps less well known, so it's on the untapped talent within the music segment, but also you're a diverse founder yourself and you are operating in the financial industry, which isn't as diverse perhaps as other industries. Can you maybe comment, and maybe interesting if you could compare maybe the entertainment business to finance in terms of maybe a diversity score you might give it, and what your experience as a founder in that context has been?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I had never really thought about it that way in terms of one versus the other. I mean, I think if you think about both the legacy of Wall Street and then the legacy of the entertainment business, they are long-standing institutions. They've been around since the turn of the century. I guess, the turn of the 19th century at this point, because we're in the 2000s, but certainly since the early 1900s. And a lot of the legacy institutions have been there for that long, whether it's the Morgan Stanleys or JP Morgans in the finance world, or it's the Warner Brothers or Universals and Sony's in the music and entertainment world. And I think what that means is in large standing, large scale institutions, they all kind of struggle a little bit with turning the tide as it relates to ensuring that diversity is running up and down the chain from a talent perspective throughout the organizations. I think that is true for large organizations. I think if you looked at both segments, you probably see not as much diversity as you would like to see in the top ranks. I would then say to you, though, that I think both segments of the market have identified a need, because they are consumer facing at the end of the day, to really make sure that their organizations reflect humanity. And so I think where you see it today versus even 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago or 25 years ago when I started in the business, you are seeing kind of a real concerted effort from the organization, certainly from the top down, to be thoughtful about all of these issues. I'd say for us as a firm at Harborview, because we're young, because we get to start from scratch, because we're led by some, like, I know how to find myself. I tell people all the time, like, I know how to find me. There is a real opportunity that we have as we build an institution of scale to really set the table differently and to really kind of lead with the ambition that I know many of these firms would love to have. But again, it's like moving a Titanic at the same time. So we have the ability to move with a little bit more speed and intention than some of these large organizations do, even despite their best efforts. And so that's why, again, I'm excited about being kind of this next generation of asset managers and inspiring others to be thinking about this too, because I think in the context of private equity as a subsector of financial services, so much younger. And when you think about youth, youth really allows for innovation, and innovation really allows for change, and change much faster. And so really encouraged by that, encouraged by the opportunity set that we see in front of us as a firm to really sort of lead in this regard. And we also think that it actually comes to better outcomes. So to your question and point earlier about identifying invested or undernourished, you know, I would call them almost desert capitals, identifying undernourished or underinvested segments of the marketplace, there's great returns there. And I think whether it's the Knight Foundation or others that have all kind of come out with the facts, and the facts are that firms that are led by diverse groups of people have ultimately performed at the highest levels, if not superseded some of the highest levels, it's because you sort of have this ability to look in places that large scale institutions either don't have the resources to look or don't have the ability to look as efficiently because of their scale. And so really excited about that, because I think for our stakeholders, which are working people, ultimately, if you think about as asset management, who do we serve? We serve the working people of this country, of this nation, certainly across the pension system, but certainly also across endowments and foundations and et cetera. We serve our communities. And as we serve those communities, I think it's behooving upon us to find and identify the best return opportunities that we can. And there's a whole segment of the market that's undernourished from a capital perspective, which to me leads to even better opportunities for return, but certainly also even for those opportunities that are undernourished and opportunities for those businesses or assets to get the capital infusion that others have been getting for a while now too. So I think there's a huge win-win for our landscape in thinking about this problem on a day-to-day basis.
And you have a remarkably diverse set of board roles, from a public company board to an arts institution to Planned Parenthood. Can you talk us through what you bring to those roles and what you think makes an effective board member?
Yeah, I'd say I love doing it. I think that it gives me so much. I love being at the table and learning. I feel like it's been a fantastic learning environment for me in all three situations. My peers and colleagues at the Evoqua board are fascinating individuals, and I get every day to sit in a completely distinct industry from mine, industrial water technology, and learn about what they're doing every day. And that's been super exciting. Being at a famous arts institution like Carnegie Hall as a native New Yorker and a classical pianist, coming up in my early years, just fascinating to watch and see and learn how arts institutions in New York City and how much they give back to not only New York City, but certainly globally. And then certainly Planned Parenthood, like watching such a large, complex and global organization that services so many and looks to provide access to so many has been just one of the greatest joys, and really being able to have a seat at the table and learn from an organization that's over 100 years old as well, with a lot of history, but certainly a lot of prescient issues in front of us as well, has been really such a joy and a pleasure to be able to serve in that way. I'd say what makes a good board member, when I look at my peers and know how much I learn from them, is really the ability to be thoughtful and strategic, to remember your role as the board is to advise and not to operate, to be thoughtful about how to support the organizations in their growth strategies or in their strategies for sustainability or for mission alignment is super important. I think having the ability to be present and not to be afraid to identify an issue or to take issues head on, I think is really important. I don't think that people want a board that is there to just rubber stamp what they've brought in front of you, but to really be questioning and reflective. So it really helps the CEOs or the leaders of those organizations to really push the organizations forward as much as possible. I think it's really important for you to do that. And I think, look, I think boards need a variety of skills. Like, I've obviously been growing up in the financial services industry. And so I kind of bring that to all of these boards, and I'm constantly placed in financial roles. Like, I serve on the audit committee of Evoqua and on Planned Parenthood, as you mentioned, I'm the treasurer and chair of the finance committee. And so that's the skill set that I bring to the table. But there are lots of skill sets that we need around the table when you're running an organization, including everything from strategic communications to thinking about org design to operational focus, et cetera. So there's a lot of skill sets that people have that I think are really impactful to board conversations that sometimes they don't even realize that they have. And so it's really about being thoughtful, strategic, having seen some things over time so that you can bring some of that perspective to the board. But certainly it's being present and actually not being afraid to question and to have curiosity around how organizations are operating and how to help them move forward in the most efficient way possible.
And any one of these organizations, they have such vast impact, I suppose, that they could be all consuming. Any one of these roles could be all consuming, just even to think of Planned Parenthood as the one example. How do you compartmentalize or allocate your time? Because between that and your full-time role, I'm sure there's a lot of demand on just the real estate up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I think kudos to these organizations, because I think having board members, a lot of times they want board members who have the experience that we all have around the table, but that also means you're getting kind of pretty busy people. And so the organizations do a really great job of supporting the board and making sure that we have the salient information that we need so that we can have really efficient time. I think it never used to be like this, right? Like, people would call me and be like, can I get on the calendar tomorrow for 12 o'clock? I'd be like, absolutely. Now I'm so planned out, like having really great organizations that have great board affairs support where they're planning out board meetings for the next 12 months is like critical for me, because that's how you can basically make sure that you're giving, you have everything spaced out, and you have enough time to serve in the right ways. So that's, I think, really important. But obviously, I spend 95% of my time on my day job and executing that and building the team we have, on building our culture, on thinking about investments, on talking to our stakeholders and our clients. That's 95% of my time, but it requires really fantastic teams. And on the Harborview side, we have a fantastic team that really supports us. So I've got 16 full-time professionals on the business. We've got other consultants that support our business. So having really strong teams really kind of makes a lot of it possible. But compartmentalizing my time is really leaning very heavily on being, you know, hyper-organized.
I can imagine. I just want to get to some personal reflections now. So obviously the music business has hits and misses, and I'm sure that in your career, you've had some setbacks or challenges. Maybe you backed a wrong horse or something similar in the music field. Were there any such challenges that you have learned lessons from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who doesn't? It's hard to be in any job or business for as long as I have and not have many setbacks, candidly, or many challenges. And so definitely have had those. I'd say the things that I have learned, which I think the one thing about setbacks or challenges is that they prime you for a showtime, if that makes sense. So some of setbacks and challenges have been over time, like not being as thoughtful as I should have been around the right partnerships to strike early on, or thinking about how to make the right capital partnership decisions have been things that I've learned a lot from. And so those have been things that have been challenges, but I don't even take them really as places of regret or should have done or would have done. I really do take them as moments of learning. And there's this saying that things happen for you, not to you. And I really believe that, right? These setbacks and challenges can feel so devastating at the time that you're going through them, but they really are creating space. If you believe in some other divine order, which I do, creating space for you to basically know and learn so that when you really do have an opportunity, the right opportunity set in front of you, you're ready to sort of lean on all those learnings. And so that has been definitely lots of things that I've been through. And I don't know that that's over, right? I think setbacks and challenges will continue to happen. We're building a new business. We'll hopefully build more than we break, but we're sure that there will be stumbles and toe stumbles as there is with any kind of organization, whether it's a brand new organization or a long standing existing organization with lots of process in place. But it's really about how you think about what the setback and the challenges is designed to do. And it's really designed to empower and to really create space for you to improve or to learn from so that you can be ready for the next opportunity.
And I want to talk about mentorship too, because I've seen you give speeches. I know that you're tremendously inspirational to a huge swathe of individuals in this finance industry, and I'm sure in the music industry too. Did you have mentors of your own? And how much is mentoring forward now? How much does that mean to you now?
It is tremendously important. I mean, I think there's no way that any individual person can know everything, right? And so if you think about that as the starting point, that means that leaning on experiences of others has been critical to doing something new or starting something new. And so there are lots of people who have influenced me who, again, I think I mentioned before, who I don't even know if they realize how impactful their 15 minutes has been with me, or there's something that they've said even to a broader audience than just me as one person that I've taken away as things that have been so helpful to me. So like I've got big brothers in my head, like the big brothers in my head include Jose Feliciano and Stefan Kulaney and Robert Smith, all of whom have either given me one-on-one advice or I've been in a room where I've been able to listen to how they've been thoughtful about building their own firms and thinking about how they've put things together, or even people like Frank Baker or Willie Woods or others, or Charles Phillips has been a large portion of my life as well. So there's lots of people in the asset management space that have done that for me. My friends and colleagues and partners at Morgan Stanley, again, I grew up there professionally for a very long time, have been fantastic partners to me, whether it's Melissa James, as I mentioned earlier, or Mohit Asimal, or somebody who probably doesn't even realize how much impact he's had on me, on how much I've thought about building out business and the thoughtfulness around being a leader. Colin Kelleher or others has been really instrumental in giving me little nuggets along the way to really be thoughtful. And then there's always your peers and your friends who have been the people to be there to lean on and to learn a little from or cry a little when things aren't going right. So people like Helen Meets, who's the CFO of PJT, is a dear friend and also a mentor of mine as well, or Kathleen McCabe, who's a partner at PJT as well, Georgetown alum, and she and I shared several stories over the years. And so just lots of really fantastic people, and all of whom I couldn't never name, but all of whom are in my head as I plot through this life and continue to make inroads on a daily basis. And certainly my partners at Apollo have been fantastic partners. I mean, 10 minutes with Mark Rowan and just watching and listening and learning as to how they thought about building the firm, or Brett Lees, who's a senior partner at Apollo, also incredibly important and super fantastic and just so generous with time to me Reggie Love, who is the key to why I'm even at Apollo, just a dear friend and a good person, a good human, really a good whisperer on how to think about things. There's just so many people, and I think it's so critical. But what I tell people all the time is people sometimes are too focused on hierarchical mentorships, i.e. trying to get to the most senior person that you can, but there's so much value in your peers also. So I have people who sit to my right and my left. We came up in the business together. We went to school together. We've done things together. And those people have been really impactful to me in terms of just nudging me along, or we're trading notes on how to get stuff done. So whether that's my good friend Damian Dwin, that started two different platforms at this point in time in his career, or my good friend Jason Howard, who was one of the people that inched me along and said, hey, you can do this on your own. You can actually start a firm on your own. Or Derek Jones and others. So like, there's just so many people who have been really fantastic partners to me that I would not be where I am without them in my professional journey at all.
I love that term whisperer, because I think there are clearly people in our lives who fill that role. Speaking of anything that got whispered, or words of wisdom, or any creed or motto that you've carried with you throughout your career, is there anything you can mention?
I think the creed or motto that we live by as a firm is really to be intellectually curious and to really be looking beyond the veil, to look a little bit deeper, to not judge a book by its cover. We think that in that context, you find really fantastic investment opportunities. And so that's, I think, been a big thing for me. And then from a human capital perspective, there is a statement that Jamaica, the country, makes all the time. And for reference, Harborview is the name of the town in Jamaica that my father grew up in. And we have a saying at home, as I call it, is out of many, one people. And so really thinking about that as we build the culture of the firm and giving everybody a window to look out of and a mirror to look into really allows us to kind of get, I think, the best and most thoughtful ideas around the table. And so those are probably the two things: to remain intellectually curious and to really be thoughtful about having perspectives around the table that allow us to allow everybody in our business to be who they are authentically without the pressure of being anything more or less than what they want to be, but certainly giving them the space to use that intellectual curiosity to find the really great opportunities that we think exist in the marketplace from an investment perspective.
And if you were to look back now to chart your course from that young girl listening to her father right through now to the role you're in, is there any advice that you would like to give your younger self?
Yeah, I think I would say it's great to learn from others, but I would say that I wish I trusted myself more. Lean on yourself more. And so I think we're doing that a lot more today and in the platform that we set up. But very frequently, you're going to be second guessed and underestimated. And there's lots of moments in time for a long time where you believe that underestimation until you prove it wrong. And then you never look back. And so I wish I could have proved that underestimation earlier, or stood in the face of that underestimation earlier. But again, everything has its own timing. But that's what I would tell my younger self and tell anybody who's coming up behind me, that you will be underestimated. People will not think that you can do it because, well, they may have never seen that many people that look like you do it before. But have conviction in what you know and what you've seen and what you've been through, to know that you have a perspective and you can lean on your gut and you don't have to play into the insecurities that other people will try to take advantage of.
Well, thank you so much, Charisse. You are such a treasure in our industry. And when you speak about the partnerships you've built, my mind kind of boggles at how many. But now that we've had this conversation, it's quite obvious why, because you are such a giver in every aspect of your life. And especially now when we look at the many committees and boards you sit on, and not only that, but also in your profession as well. A giver, it tends to come back to you. So I can see now why. And thank you for coming here and sharing your wisdom with us.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, listen, I'm so excited to have spent time with you. And thank you so much for doing this. I know that you are bringing insights to all of us in the asset management world. And I think it's amazing. So thank you so much for doing this and having me join you.
Well, I hope thanks to some of your learnings, we too can be primed for showtime. So thank you. I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.